Good morning. It's Friday, March 23rd. I don't know about you, but I find this stuff with Gonzalez and the U.S. Attorney's firings quite exciting. I sense a real battle brewing, a storm coming. Well, we'll see. Welcome to Electric Politics. I'm George Kenney. To be honest, I'm not quite sure I was able to do justice to today's guest, as we only managed to cover a few of the main themes of his recent book, leaving out several others that are also critically important. But I've long thought, and I believe that research supports this, it's easier to make sense of something when it's taken in parts prompted by questions, rather than in predetermined, complete outline form. I think Socrates would agree also. For the full story, I unhesitatingly recommend Tad's book, The Upside of Down, and you can find out more on his website, www.homerdixon.com. We talk for 58 minutes. Let's listen. Today, I'm delighted to have as my guest Dr. Thomas Homer Dixon. He's the director of the Trudeau Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Toronto. For a complete bio, please see the links from EP. Dr. Homer Dixon's research focuses on threats to global security in the 21st century, particularly how societies cope, or don't, with the possibility of catastrophic failure. His books include Environment, Scarcity, and Violence, Princeton, 1999, which won the Caldwell Prize of the American Political Science Association, The Ingenuity Gap, NOPF 2000, which won the Governor General's Nonfiction Award, and most recently, The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization, NOPF 2006, which hasn't yet won any awards but presumably will. Dr. Homer Dixon was born in Victoria, British Columbia. He received his BA from Carleton University and his PhD from MIT. Welcome, Tad.
Very good to be with you.
Now, I've gone over some of the interviews that you've given and some of the things that people have written about your most recent book, and it seems to me generally your interviewers like to go over all the details about catastrophe, but generally tend to pass over quickly the question of values. And you've got sort of a background theme talking about values all through your book, and towards the end of the book you make some of your ideas a little bit more explicit, but in your interviews you don't seem to have gotten much of a chance to talk about the question of values. So I'd like to start with that. What do you think is the main problem with today's values in Western societies?
I think this is the big silence in much of our public discussion about the challenges we face as societies and as a species. And I'm glad you've raised it, and I'm glad it's raised right at the beginning. It's a topic, when I do my presentations to public audiences, it's a topic mm-hmm. that almost always comes up when you dig down deeply into the challenges we face, whether we're talking about climate change or energy or economic imbalances, widening gaps between rich and poor people. Mm-hmm. You generally find down at the base are certain value orientations towards the world. And probably one of the most important, I think, that is driving a lot of the problems we're facing is a very, and it sounds maybe a little bit commonplace or almost trite to say this, but a very materialistic culture, materially oriented culture that emphasizes consumerism, that emphasizes short-term, almost hedonistic pleasures. I like to distinguish between three kinds of values, what I call utilitarian values, which are simple likes and dislikes. I like vanilla ice cream better than chocolate ice cream, for example. Moral values, which relate to issues of fairness and justice among people, not just among us at any one period in time, but potentially across generations. And then finally, what I call existential, or some people might call spiritual values, mm-hmm. which relate to our position in the cosmos, in the world, and mm-hmm. the answers to the questions that some of us have when we're young, like why are we here, and what is the meaning of life, and what gives us meaning.
Yeah.
And What we tend to do, I think, is spend a lot of time talking about how we satisfy the first kind of values, utilitarian values, but we don't spend much time talking about moral values and especially existential values. And yet it turns out that what we view as the good life, what we think brings us meaning into our lives, is perhaps one of the most important judgments we make. It determines so many other things about the nature of our societies and ultimately about the opportunities and options for our children and whether they will have the kinds of options that we've had in the past.
Well, where have we gone off track? Or do you locate any particular time frame within the recent past where things have changed in terms of how we think about values?
Human beings have forever been concerned about their immediate material needs, and they're very important material needs for shelter, for basic security, for food. I mean, we live in a time in history where, remarkably, most of those basic material needs have been taken care of. It's a very unusual time when you look through across the whole course of human history.
Mm-hmm.
In the majority of the time span of the human species, these things have not been. You couldn't take them for granted. You couldn't take for granted the fact that you would have a meal tomorrow or security for your children and have a life of good health, a long life of good health, the way most of us take for granted today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that what has happened, especially in the last few decades, is that we have continued to accumulate the stuff that has made us secure in those ways far beyond the level at which we've become secure. And in fact, if you look at psychological studies, we are twice as wealthy on average in North America as we were in 1950. We have twice as much stuff of mm-hmm. various kinds. We consume twice as many goods and services. And this is after you account for inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And we're no happier. In fact, in the United States, happiness has declined a little bit. So you have to wonder why we're obsessed with accumulating more stuff and why we're obsessed with economic growth. Economic growth is a sacrosanct concept in our popular discourse among policymakers, among our opinion elites. Hardly anybody questions whether it's really essential within our already very rich societies. We all know that it's good to grow and that we need more growth. And yet it's not making us any happier.
You mentioned in your book Herman Daly, who I interviewed actually fairly recently, and one of the things that he had done, which I thought was fairly imaginative, was to go back and try to construct an index of things that you would think would make people feel better or happier, and to try to correlate that with economic growth. And it turns out that up to a point, it does correlate, but then after that, you get you have to have a whole lot of growth for very little improvements in people's welfare.
That's right. The research in this is actually quite definitive, and it's remarkable how little attention that's received. But above about $13,000 to $15,000 of income, U.S. dollars of income per year, the correlation between increased income and happiness just breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the very wealthiest people in the United States, and they're actually, on average, not much happier than middle-class people in the United States. If you look across countries, you find that, people in the wealthiest countries tend to be happier, but they don't tend to be much happier. The ones who are at the top of that heap, like the United States and Canada and others, don't tend to be much happier than moderately wealthy countries that are just over that $15,000 per capita threshold. And if you look across time, as I mentioned before, as countries become wealthier, happiness tends not to go up once they've crossed that threshold. So all of these things suggest that really, you know, we're valuing the wrong things. To get back to your original question,
mm-hmm,
we're focusing on accumulation, material accumulation that drives an extraordinary engine of consumption within our economies, and it's not really satisfying us. And the things that Herman Daly would point to that really do make us happier tend to be intangibles and related to social relationships and the quality of life in terms of our connections with other people, whether we have loving families, whether we feel secure in our social relationships, whether we have work that we find pleasing and engaging. And these are the things that often aren't related to wealth at all.
And in terms of values, there are also, let's see how to put this, practical values that are maybe not immediately part of a set of happiness values, but that are very important. In one of your talks, you talked about the idea of prudence and how it used to be that a couple generations ago you'd have little girls named Prudence, and you don't find that anymore because people don't think prudence is so important now. But that would be an important value that, that people had for a great deal of our history, I should think.
That's right. And in fact, I'd put that in under sort of the general category of values or attitudes that enhance resilience.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to name a little girl Prudence nowadays, you'd be regarded as having done her enormous harm.
Right.
She'd be teased all the way through. We live in a bungee jumping culture. We think it's cool to push things to the limit, but that's because we've had a period of time in human history, especially within our societies, where we've largely buffered ourselves from the sharp and often very harmful shocks of the external environment. As I mentioned before, during the majority of human history, people were living on the edge. They were very vulnerable. And I think what we're going to find in this coming century is that those external pressures are returning in various ways, and that we need to return to an attitude or an ethic of prudence in some respects, and that will help make our societies and our lives more resilient.
Okay, well, let's then talk about a couple of these pressures, and let's start with peak oil and perhaps work backwards from there. And I would note, before getting to my question, that the idea of peak oil is relatively new, and you have, although you have Hubbert writing quite some time ago, you have people like Simmons, who presumably would have known all about the oil business from being in investment banking to do with it, but who only recently came around to talking about it within the last 5 or 6 years, and others. To give us a bit of the benefit of the doubt, it is a new idea. But one peak oil, I didn't see this in the book, but in one interview you gave, I believe that you cited a time frame for peak oil of about 20 to 30 years, which would be roughly what the International Energy Agency and the Energy Information Administration here in Washington are saying. But the more dire peak oil people are saying that we've actually hit peak oil right now at this very moment. And I was just wondering, what is your best guess about the time frame?
It's so hard to say. You know, I adopt the time frame of the USGS and International Energy Agency and of the Cambridge Energy Research Associates, you know, three groups that are all really quite optimistic about the peak oil situation. I adopt that time frame because I think that even within that optimistic time frame, we still face a huge challenge. And I think by doing that, we get ourselves away from a debate about when peak is actually going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're quite right. There's some people who say that we may have well passed peak for conventional oil in 2005 or 2006.
Right.
Colin Campbell, in his latest newsletter from Ireland, and I've been following Colin's work very closely for a long time,
mm-hmm.
Says that we reached peak of conventional oil in 2005. Mm-hmm. ExxonMobil, who's basically denied the possibility of peak for a long time, has now acknowledged that non-OPEC production will probably peak around 2010, 2011. The USGS study is interesting because it's the source, I think, of almost all of the most optimistic scenarios regarding oil production on the planet.
Right.
And its methodology is profoundly flawed. The most important thing I think one can say about the USGS study now is that its projections started in 1995. So we're now 12 years into its projections.
Right.
And they are wildly off. They were expecting that we would find somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25 billion barrels of oil a year, and we're actually finding only 10 or even less on an annual basis. So But even that, let's just assume the optimists are right. A 20-year time frame to get ready for a peak is a very short period of time. Energy infrastructures take a long time to turn over. The design of our cities, of our suburbs, the infrastructure we're using for transportation and energy distribution, the kinds of technologies we're using in our power production for electricity, for example. Mm-hmm. A coal-fired power plant has a lifespan of 50 or 60 years. So a 20-year time frame to adjust to sharply higher energy prices is not much time at all. And the other important thing in terms of this debate between optimists and pessimists is that given the rate of growth in conventional oil consumption in the world, which is around 2-3% a year, being driven largely by India and China, mm-hmm. given that rate of growth, even if you make very optimistic assumptions about the amount of conventional oil still available to be found on the planet, it doesn't push peak out very far.
Right.
If you assume, as the pessimists do, that we have about a trillion barrels of oil left on the planet in the what they call the URR, or the ultimately recoverable resource, then we will be peaking somewhere around now. If you double that URR to 2 trillion barrels, you peak somewhere around 2025, 2030. You don't get a lot for doubling your ultimately recoverable resource. And so this is a challenge that is pretty well inevitable. We've seen peak in 50 oil-producing regions around the world. There's absolutely no reason why we're not going to see it for the planet as a whole, and we're not ready for it.
And, well, there was a debate just in the past couple of days on some of the oil blogs about whether the superfield Ghawar in Saudi Arabia has peaked or not. Of course, nobody really knows, but you can interpret various signs in a number of ways.
Well, Simmons, of course, he lays out a very persuasive case in his latest book. Now, what impresses me about some of these peak oil guys is many of them are geologists mm-hmm. or deeply, deeply engaged with the oil industry. Simmons was an investment financer and banker for the oil industry for many years.
The multi-billions of dollars, yeah, a huge firm,
And in the service sector, too. So he says he's seen the... in a very intimate way, the back end of the technology of oil production, how you keep oil fields going, and he wasn't a peak proponent early in his career.
Right.
He came to it as his understanding of the geology and of the technology evolved over time, and you see this with a lot of the people who are peak proponents. They've come to recognize over time that oil fields have this characteristic of rising to a peak and then declining in production. And there's really a very interesting distinction here between economists and geologists.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like the distinction on climate change between, say, economists and climate scientists or environmentalists. The economists will say, well, you just let prices rise and technology will kick in. There will be incentive to find new sources, and for all intents and purposes, the resource is essentially inexhaustible.
Right.
The geologists think this is just ludicrous. That, you know, we're not living on an infinitely sized planet, and at some point, the resource limits will be reached. And that dispute, I think, it's almost an ideological, almost a religious dispute of almost religious characteristics in terms of the deep beliefs these two groups share. Or don't share, I should say, that the deep beliefs that these two groups within themselves share.
It's a theological dispute.
Absolutely.
That's right. Yeah. All right. Well, let's try to put the question of energy then in a larger, more general context. In your book, you refer a lot to the example of Rome, and then you generalize from that and kind of abstract from it. What have you learned using the example of Rome, and what should we learn, you think?
Energy is just critically important to everything we do. I call it the master resource. If you've got lots of energy, then you can do a lot of other things in order to solve your problems. But if you don't have much energy, or if energy is very expensive, then it makes everything else much more difficult. And so within my work, I'm finding that energy is a common theme all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to illustrate some of the issues related to energy by looking at the Roman Empire, and in particular, the reasons for the collapse of the Western Roman Empire between about the 1st century AD and the 5th century AD.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all interested in Rome, of course. We all want to know why it collapsed, and a number of years ago, an eminent German social scientist and historian did a survey of all of the reasons adduced for Rome's collapse going back many centuries, and he did a long list of them, and there's something like 320 different reasons. And interestingly enough, in that entire list, energy isn't mentioned once.
Really? Wow.
And yet, recent archaeological evidence suggests that that a fundamental reason for the collapse of the Western Roman Empire was an energy crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me just elaborate on that a bit. Rome was what specialists call a proximate solar society. It was powered essentially by the sun's energy. The sunlight fell on its fields. The Romans grew alfalfa and wheat in those fields, and other agricultural products too, but those are two of the primary ones.
Mm-hmm.
And they fed the alfalfa to oxen and the wheat to human beings. And the muscles of the oxen and of the human beings built the empire. And so you can trace energy flows. It's a really reasonably tractable problem. You can trace energy flows through the Roman Empire from the field to all of the tasks that Rome was engaged in.
So you calculated how much energy it took to build the Colosseum, for example.
To build the Colosseum. It was an interesting exercise. I was in Rome, and I was doing a tourist visit to the Colosseum, and I happened to look at one of the large arches in the exterior ring of the Colosseum, and I thought to myself about the keystone in that arch. Very large stone, about probably about 3 feet high and 3 feet wide and about 8 feet long, weighing about probably 2.5 tons.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about the work, the energy that was required to cut that stone out of the quarry,
mm-hmm.
shape it, cart it 30 kilometers to the Colosseum work site, hoist it into place, and as part of the arch and then as part of the larger Colosseum. And I asked myself, how much land did it take to grow the food, to produce the energy, to power the muscles, to put that keystone in place? I thought it was going to be a reasonably straightforward calculation, but I spent a fair amount of time in my book actually walking through the calculation, especially for the whole Colosseum, what was involved in building the Colosseum and how much land was required to generate the energy to build the Colosseum.
And how much of it is invisible as opposed to being visible, the concrete foundations and so forth?
Right. Almost 90% of the Colosseum happens to be underground in terms of its mass, enormous foundation underground. And it turns out, you know, we spent almost a year working on this calculation learned a lot about energy in the process and energy in society in the process. And it turns out that at an absolute minimum, this is an extremely conservative estimate, the amount of land that was required to generate the energy to build the Colosseum was 55 square kilometers, which is about the same as the area of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And it was required every year for 5 years. The building was built over a 5-year period. So you had to set aside that amount of land essentially for 5 years to construct one building. Now, the city of Rome itself was at its peak, 1 to 1.5 million people would have required an area about the size of modern-day Lebanon to feed itself. The Roman Empire as a whole required an area about the size of modern-day France to feed itself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing about this energy thesis is there's a fundamental argument here, which is that societies require energy to generate and sustain complexity, complex institutions and technologies, to solve their problems. And as their problems become more difficult, they need more complex institutions and technologies, and they need, as a result, higher flows of higher quality energy. Now, what was happening to Rome in the first centuries AD is that it was rapidly becoming more complex.
Mm-hmm.
Let's think about urbanization for a moment. Rome was the most urbanized agrarian society in history. The Italian peninsula was about 20% urbanized.
Mm-hmm.
The province of Egypt was 30% urbanized. Now, keep in mind that any agrarian society up to that point and afterwards had about a maximum level of urbanization of about 5%. And the reason is because all the people in the cities aren't producing food.
Mm-hmm.
They are essentially parasites on the food that's being produced in the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to levels of 20 or 30%, you have to be very organized in extracting energy from the countryside in order to sustain the complexity of the cities. Now, Rome had not only enormous cities, but huge numbers of people in those cities relying upon free grain handouts, hundreds of thousands of people in Rome and Alexandria and Carthage and elsewhere. It had a very large army.
Mm-hmm.
The army doubled in size from 300,000 to 600,000 men over a period of about a century and a half. It required 200,000 tons of grain a year just to feed the army alone. It had an expanding bureaucracy and a much more complex civil institution, set of civil institutions. And all of this complexity required an increasing flow of energy. And what happened by about the beginning of the 3rd century AD, that Rome simply couldn't provide the energy that it required to sustain this increasing complexity. And it entered a period of many decades of profound crisis, constant barbarian attacks, a fiscal crisis, the falling value of the currency because the currency was diluted with copper, and assassinations of emperors and coup d'etat of various kinds.
So the running out of energy was kind of the base for underlying all of these other crises that up until recently, I guess, had been the standard kind of story in history books where, well, there were problems with the emperor or problems with the Senate or barbarians.
That's right.
Whatever.
Exactly. People tended to look at the proximate causes of the crisis, barbarian attacks or an assassination or something like that, a revolt by the Praetorian Guard, and have not looked at these deeper pressures. And in all my research, I'm interested in these deeper pressures that are stressing the resilience of societies, making them more brittle over time. And that's what was happening with Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the last part of the story, I think, is particularly interesting and makes it particularly relevant today because the Emperor Diocletian came to power around 280, 285, and he recognized, not that the empire faced an energy crisis, they wouldn't have thought of it in those terms, but he recognized that the empire faced a fiscal crisis.
Mm-hmm.
It was essentially the same thing. Empire wasn't able to extract sufficient energy from its countryside to sustain itself, to sustain all of this complexity that I was talking about a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sent his surveyors out across the territory of the empire to identify every scrap of agricultural land, to identify or assess the quality of each of those scraps of agricultural land, and to assign each piece of agricultural land to a cultivator. And if that person couldn't or wouldn't cultivate it, then it was assigned to somebody else. And if that person, the farmer, died, then the land was assigned to the widow or the children, and they were responsible for the taxes. And in extremis, if those people couldn't pay the taxes on the land, then the land was assigned to the local village or town, and the town as a whole was responsible for the taxes on the land. And the result was that the entire empire was converted into basically a system for generating energy for the central authorities. Enormous amounts of food was extracted from the countryside, converted, of course, into silver and gold, and then that silver and gold was used to run the empire. Now, this extraction of energy stabilized the empire for an extended period of time, about 70 or 80 years. But it also set up a system whereby emperors after Diocletian could increase taxes in the countryside. And they did so, and the result eventually was a collapse of the rural peasantry. The rural economy started to collapse as peasants either didn't have children to sustain their families or moved out of the countryside into cities because they couldn't withstand the tax rates anymore. And it was this underlying change, this rural crisis, an underlying change in the nature of the economy and energy extraction in the Western Roman Empire that ultimately led to its collapse.
I suppose probably the peasants started to feel that they had been turned into slaves, and knowing that they hadn't really been slaves in the past, it must have been a serious problem for them, just trying to, you know, psychologically adapt. And obviously then a lot of them didn't.
Well, specialists have done kind of an energy surplus calculation for the peasantry in various parts of the empire, and this was essentially subsistence agriculture in many cases. They didn't have a lot of surplus that could be taxed away in the first place, and when the representatives of the emperor, the taxmen, kept coming and demanding more and more of that surplus and eventually cutting into the underlying energy that the families needed themselves to support themselves, the results would have been things like having fewer children or not being able to feed your children properly, so your children's mortality went up. And the economy in the countryside was on the cusp anyway all the time and very susceptible to vagaries of climate. And what happened with this increasing tax rate is that it just made it more and more brittle.
Do we know if at the same time this was happening, whether the wealthy class in Rome did better relatively or...
They did. In fact, increasingly over time during these centuries, the wealthiest elites became vastly wealthier, became vastly more powerful in terms of the territory they controlled across the empire. Land was a principal source of power, political and economic power, and it was accumulated in just staggering quantities by a relatively small number of families. I think in my book I mentioned that towards the end of the 3rd century AD, about 40 families controlled most of the Italian peninsula. And of course, what was happening as peasants were leaving the countryside, they were looking for security in various places. They went to the cities so they could get the dole, the grain handout, or they associated themselves with certain large landowners in essentially a proto-feudal arrangement. Early feudalism started this way because at least the landowners might be able to take care of them. And that was the beginning, in some ways, of the transition to a feudal economy.
Well, so there are actually a lot of parallels with what we've got today, with the people who are super rich getting vastly richer, and the middle class shrinking, even in industrial countries, or at least in the United States. I don't think that's true actually in Europe, but and the poor and worldwide, as you talk about in your book. Really struggling at the starting line, so we do have this disequilibrium.
In some ways, I think the most interesting parallel with Rome. There's certainly the parallel, as you mentioned, but in terms of the increasing gap between the super rich and to a large extent a marginalized poor. But the other very interesting parallel is the response to the energy crisis. And we are coming up to a transition from a petroleum to a post-petroleum age. This is best characterized in terms of a concept that I have drawn from the energy specialist community. It's the idea of the energy return on investment, or the EROI, which is basically how much energy do you get back for an investment of a certain amount of energy to get energy. Now, if you look at Texas in the 1930s, the people who were drilling the wells there got back about 100 barrels of oil for every barrel of oil of energy they invested to drill into the ground and pump oil out. Today, the energy return on investment in the United States for conventional oil is around 17 to 1. And if you look at the tar sands in Alberta, which is considered a fallback energy source for the United States in coming decades as conventional energy becomes much scarcer, the amount of energy you get back is about 4 to 1. Now, as you slide down that slope from 100 to 1 to 17 to 1 to 4 to 1 towards 1 to 1, you have to invest as a society more of your capital and wealth in simply producing energy, and you have less left over for all the other things you need to do, including dealing with your increasingly difficult problems, such as, for instance, climate change, which is solutions. Just about every solution that we can think up to climate change is going to take a lot of energy. Now, Rome was facing a very similar energy return on investment crisis in its in these early centuries AD. It had been able to sustain itself for a long period of time by essentially seizing the treasuries of other empires, the Syrian Empire, the Macedonian Empire. And the gold in those treasuries, for all intents and purposes, was like distilled solar energy.
Mm-hmm.
And when those treasuries ran out around 120 AD, the Roman Empire had to sustain itself on energy it could simply extract on a year-to-year basis from the countryside through its taxation system.
Mm-hmm.
So its energy return on investment regime changed to the negative very rapidly and very suddenly.
Mm.
And that was kind of the precipitating factor for the crisis it faced. We're confronting a similar sort of situation in the world today. Rome under Diocletian responded by regimenting the entire countryside of the empire, every scrap of land, as I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
I would expect that the energy-hungry powers and societies in the world today, Europe, China, India, Japan, the United States, all of whom are already importing a very significant portion of their energy, will go out across the territory of the entire planet, regimented entirely, to try to identify every last pool of high-quality energy and extract that energy and bring it back to the core of their societies to maintain their core complexity.
Which is what we're doing, essentially, with our wars in the U.S., anyway, with our wars in Iraq. And it's what the Chinese are doing, locking up
exactly.
future energy now, supplies in Africa. And
it's not only by military means. A lot of this is happening through what we would regard as entirely legal and legitimate corporate means, by using trade relations, by establishing contracts that allow or permit access to pools of energy in various parts of the world. But there is this regimentation process of the surface of the planet going on,
mm-hmm.
where every corner is being searched and ransacked to find out what energy is there. And then people are staking their claims to it, planting a flag on it, either economically and financially through some kind of contract, and in some cases militarily. And I think anybody who says that what is happening in the Gulf is not related to energy is simply fooling themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, but how do you see this competition for declining supplies, particularly between the U.S. and China? The Chinese have this; they're all on a kind of an awful treadmill. They have to keep growing, otherwise they'll have terrible social problems.
Exactly.
They're locked into some completely macabre dance with the United States, where we pretend to send them money and they send us stuff.
Exactly.
At some point, that whole system is just going to break down, and then behind it all, there's this competition for the oil.
Energy. That's exactly right. I couldn't have put it any better. We have essentially what I call a twin bubbles symbiosis, economic bubbles symbiosis between China and the United States. The United States buys Chinese stuff, and the Chinese lend the United States money to buy the stuff, and that consumption engine is driving the world economy in many respects and driving the growth of the world economy. It's not sustainable ecologically over the long term in terms of impact on the global climate. China will exceed American output of CO2 in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not sustainable in terms of resource inputs, in terms of energy. China has moved from a net exporter of conventional oil to very rapidly to a net importer of conventional oil. In 1993, they were a net exporter. Now they import about 50% of their conventional oil. And in about 10 or 15 years, they'll be importing about 75% of their conventional oil.
Mm-hmm.
Now they can offset some of that problem by liquefying coal. They have huge coal reserves, of course.
Mm-hmm.
There are consequences for the climate because coal is very dirty in terms of carbon dioxide, but they can compensate a bit for declining availability of petroleum elsewhere in the world by liquefying coal. But people don't have a full understanding. I think the average person doesn't have a full understanding of the scale of the energy requirements of a country like China or of the world as a whole or a country like the United States. The inputs of energy, especially oil, are absolutely breathtaking and steadily increasing. So I would expect that the competition for oil is going to become quite severe between these energy-hungry powers in coming decades. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a complicated story. If there is an economic crisis of some kind, I think you alluded to that possibility, because this symbiosis between China and the United States starts to break down, mm-hmm. then that will reduce economic demand, and it will reduce demand, at least for a period of time, mm-hmm. for energy resources. Mm-hmm. And that might sort of extend our current energy resources for a somewhat longer period of time. But as long as these economies are booming, their energy consumption will go up. And as you point out, China has to have 8 to 10% economic growth a year simply to sustain civil stability and peace within the society. Even as it was, they had 80,000 mass protests last year, according to officially released statistics.
Astonishing, yeah.
Astonishing. A lot of these are in rural areas where people don't feel that wealth is reaching them or their land is being gobbled up by speculators. The only way the Chinese know to keep the lid on things socially is by maintaining very high levels of economic growth. So we're really in a box here, and it's not obvious how we're going to get out.
Well, I don't know the answer to that either. Let me ask a different question going at this then. Logically, as we see that oil and gas becomes more scarce, we should put more investment into alternatives. And my question is, why aren't we doing that?
I think we're starting to see some movement of capital in those areas. Some of the things that are happening along along Sand Hill Road in California are very interesting in terms of the venture capitalists and the stream of money they're pouring into alternative energy. We've seen significant investments in Europe, but nothing on the scale of what I think is necessary. I guess this brings us to the other part of the argument I make in my most recent book, which, as you said, is titled The Upside of Down. We can talk about the upside a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are very deeply entrenched political and economic vested interests that are preventing the kind of change that we need to address some of the problems we face. And it's unlikely that we're going to make the change of the magnitude we need until there's a crisis of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, frequently societies just don't get going. They don't have the opportunity or the motivation even to make profound changes until there's a shock, a breakdown, a crisis of some kind. It took the Great Depression to create the conditions for FDR to fundamentally reform American capitalism, which laid the foundation for American power for the next half century. And I would expect that in the future, it's impossible to say when, it could be in the short term, it could be further down the road, say 10, 15, 20 years, that there will be what specialists could call system discontinuities, which I just call breakdowns or crisis,
yeah.
that will provide the political constituency, the popular groundswell of interest in fundamental changes. Right at the moment, it's just not there. We're all too deep in denial, and there are a lot of vested interests that are really encouraging that denial.
To pick up what you just said, you're describing it in empirical terms, but actually there's an abstract argument there as well that you write about. A number of researchers, people you've talked to and others, look at complex systems and they find similar recurring patterns of growth and then decay and then renewal. And I know that you have a disagreement, a minor disagreement, I guess, with Jared Diamond over this, where he thinks that we can avoid a breakdown or a catastrophe, and you're saying, as you just did, that probably that's got to be the stimulus for some sort of a change. But to what extent in the complex system that we live in are we locked into this kind of a cycle?
It's the idea that I develop in the book, and as you quite rightly point out, it's drawn from some research in complex systems theory, especially among ecologists, that has been done over the last 20 years,
mm-hmm.
Emphasizes the role of what I would call constrained breakdown in adaptation. The most adaptive systems in the world, ecological systems, economic systems, immune systems, go through periods of growth, complexification, breakdown, reorganization, and regrowth. The breakdown isn't catastrophic. It isn't calamitous, because at that, if it were, there wouldn't be any possibility for recovery. But there is a loosening of the bonds in the system, a crisis of some kind that then produces a reorganization and a regrowth and an adaptation to new circumstances. Now, this is an idea that was captured wonderfully by the great Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter in his phrase, creative destruction.
Mm-hmm.
We know that our modern market economies, probably the most adaptive institutions human beings have ever created, are adaptive precisely because of creative destruction. Companies will be founded, they will grow, they'll become more complex over time, more powerful, often successful for a while, but then eventually rigid and perhaps maladapted to their environment, they'll go bankrupt, and the capital and human capital and expertise and knowledge and information within those companies will often be reorganized within the economy and used in new ways. And that's the source of the adaptation of economy. Sometimes this can happen to whole economic sectors, as we saw during the dot-com boom and the implosion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to our social and political affairs, we don't think in the same terms. In fact, if somebody were to say we need a little bit of creative destruction on the political side, it sounds just marginally revolutionary and not very palatable. And yet somehow we need to incorporate into our political and social institutions the same kind of mechanism of adaptation that we have in our markets, the same capacity for constrained crisis and breakdown that allows us to reorganize ourselves, to break through vested interests, to generate the motivations for really more profound change.
So that kind of gets at a question that I had in my mind reading through your book, the whole thing, where in your prescriptions you're saying, okay, we need more open source type stuff and collaborative networking and things like that, but you don't, as far as I could tell, get much into the subject of national government's structures. And as we deal with this at various levels, at the local level, as you say, building in more resilience, at the international level, having institutions that can deal effectively with things like climate change. Where do you see the structural problems on a national scale, and what kinds of constitutional reforms do you think we should be thinking about, if any?
The state or the national government doesn't play a large role in my current thinking, and the number of people have pointed that out. Perhaps it should, and it's something that I need to think about more. But my general sense has been, as I've been thinking about these problems and how we should respond to these problems, that a lot of power is moving away from large organizations and national governments and states towards subgroups and even to individuals. That's a technologically driven process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that we more or less just have to accept. One thing that hasn't moved along with that power is responsibility, a certain sense that as you become more capable of analyzing your situation as an individual, of communicating with others, of gumming up the political system by generating vast quantities of email and information on your own from your own computer, that you actually bear a larger and larger responsibility for your own governance. And I want to see more attention paid to what kinds of alternative collective action is possible on the part of large numbers of individuals operating independently of our conventional political institutions. How can we get very large numbers of people together to collaboratively work in perhaps some kind of open source architecture on the common problems we have, energy, climate, and thinking about how we're going to respond collectively to various possible crises in the future, to develop scenarios for what those crises might look like.
Now, so for example, local government in Northern Virginia, which I follow, I have an apartment over there in Northern Virginia, they've started to look at how peak oil might affect this area. And so there does seem to be room for how local initiatives can try to think ahead for these things.
Exactly. And my argument in many respects is about developing the capacity of individual units within our complex systems, towns, villages, communities, right down to the level of individual households, mm-hmm. being able to take care of themselves a little bit more, mm-hmm. to the extent that they can provide for their own needs in a time of crisis, then the whole system becomes more resilient, and we're all better off. At the moment, we're all so tightly coupled together and so interdependent that when there is a shock in one part of the system, perhaps even on the other side of the planet, everybody is affected. Mm-hmm. And that's not a very resilient system. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm very interested in how this kind of larger democratic conversation about these issues can take place within an internet-based environment. Mm-hmm. I am struck by the fact that at the very time when our species faces perhaps the greatest challenges it's ever faced, we have in place, coincidentally on the planet, the infrastructure for a rudimentary form of species-wide democracy, and that's the internet. We don't use it effectively. For the most part, the internet is simply a venue for a kind of cacophony of narcissism, mm-hmm. where everybody is blogging at each other, and it seems to bring out really the worst in some people's personalities. They become extraordinarily aggressive and real bullies on the internet. Mm-hmm. And yet we see clusters of activity in places like Wikipedia, for example, where mm-hmm. you get large numbers of people together to solve complex problems in a much more voluntaristic and collaborative way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would say that the open source movement is likely to be, when we look back on it in a while, one of the most interesting social innovations in the last century. If somebody had said 10 years ago, we're going to develop an encyclopedia, it's going to have 4 million entries, it's going to be internet-based, the culture of participation in this activity will be voluntaristic, collaborative, and for the most part, people will leave their egos at the door. Anyone, anywhere in the world can change any entry, anytime. And we're going to run this project for 6 years, and then we're going to bring in some experts from the scientific journal Nature to look at the science entries. And they're going to determine that, for the most part, those science entries are just about as good as the Encyclopedia Britannica's. And if somebody had said that 10 years ago, we would say, oh, that's nonsense. Human beings just aren't like that. It's impossible. And yet there it is. It exists, and Wikipedia is now, I think, ranked as the fourth most visited site in the world. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I would like to take some aspects of that architecture out for a spin, think about how they could be scaled up and used to address some of our really very significant social and political problems and mm-hmm, economic mm-hmm. problems around the world, such as the ones we've been talking about.
There isn't anybody actually doing that. I mean, if you look at Move On, for example, they've adopted kind of like an electronic mailing list paradigm where they've got a lot of people who are subscribers to their system, but there's no flexibility for the members. It's all of a top-down kind of a deal. I've been to some training sessions where Move On and others are trying to train democratic activists in the new technology, and it's not really a new technology in their hands. It's new tools with old ideas about how political activity should proceed. Anyway, just a remark on that. But nobody, as far as I know, has done anything like what you're describing in political terms.
I think that we are very constrained by our discourse, by the categories through which we see political possibilities and possibilities of democracy. I'm talking about a much more radical kind of democracy, mm-hmm. And much more of an agora, where the process of democratic discussion involves education of participants, socialization of participants, into the give and take, the thoughtfulness, the respect, the tolerance that's required for an effective democracy. And instead, we see democracy very much in terms of delegation of power to a relatively small number of selected individuals, delegation of authority to technocratic elites, occasional participation in an election process, people sort of turn on their attention to political affairs and social affairs once in a while when perhaps a presidential election comes along or something like this, and then they turn off and simply think about their own lives for the rest of the time. Whereas the kind of process I'm thinking of would be a much deeper understanding of citizenship, essentially, and of political participation, of democratic participation, where people are engaged in an ongoing process of thinking about the range of issues that affect their lives and taking responsibility themselves rather than simply delegating it to others. Mm-hmm. We all want a leader or a technocrat to come along and simply give us the answers. I can't tell you how many times people have said to me, they find my book a little bit disappointing because I don't have a checklist of answers at the end. They're really annoyed with me. So who are you? Why don't you just give us the answers? So I have one person enter on my forum recently, you know, well, this is just all very depressing. What are we supposed to do? And my answer is, I don't know exactly what we're supposed to do. We have to figure that out together. And you have to start taking responsibility for making some of those choices and exploring some of the answers yourself. This is something that... It's something about growing up, fundamentally. It's like we have to grow up in terms of our understanding of our own capability to take care of ourselves and govern ourselves.
You actually just answered my next question, but I'll pose it anyway because of the premise. I think that one of your key insights is that bad people, to generalize, you argue, I think correctly, are psychologically prepared and perhaps to some extent organizationally prepared for societal breakdown, whereas more normal people really aren't. And so you've just told me what you think of how we get at that, and I agree with you. There aren't any answers, and it's not an easy process. So that it is very frustrating for people not to have a checklist of things to do.
And by the way, I just want to emphasize what you said there because it's a point that I make. I think it's one of the most important points in my book, and it's remarkable how few people have actually drawn attention to it. I hang it on the hook of W.B. Yeats' famous line from the poem Second Coming, where he says, when things fall apart, the worst are full of passionate intensity and the best lack all conviction. And he basically, quite rightly, divided the world into two categories, what I would call now extremists and non-extremists. Extremists at a time of crisis will... often know what they want, they'll be networked together, they'll have resources laid aside, and they'll be ready to go. They'll be very well organized. The rest of us in a time of crisis, non-extremists will be wandering around saying, gee, this is really bad. I wish we could organize ourselves to do something about this. Mm-hmm. If there's any one fundamental point in my book, if there's one that I were to draw out, I'd say, if we want to make sure that in those moments of contingency following a crisis, when things are very flexible and fluid, if we want to make sure that we can push the world in a positive direction, we have to start thinking about it now, not wait until the time happens. We need to start laying down plans, building that social capital, building the networks, thinking about what we're going to do now rather than waiting till the crisis actually hits. Mm-hmm. Because, and this is, if you go back to that example of the Great Depression, North America, and the United States in particular, were very fortunate that FDR not only came to power, but had the political capacity to move the United States in a positive direction. The same crisis produced Nazi Germany in Europe. Mm-hmm. That was a moment of contingency. One society went down one path that produced a relatively positive outcome. The other society went down another path that produced a horrendous crisis. What I'm suggesting now is that we actually have some forewarning that there are crises in the future, that there are crises coming. We can't know exactly what they're going to look like, but we can start planning, at least in a rudimentary way now.
Ted, I had some other questions, but I think that is really the best point at which to leave this conversation. It's really an excellent summary of what you're doing, and I hope that perhaps we can come back to this in further conversations. But I want to thank you very much for your book and for talking with me. What you're saying is fascinating and extremely important. I'm sure that the listeners have found it very interesting as well. So thank you very much.
Very good. And I've really been delighted to talk to you today.
Excellent, Tad. Thank you again. I really like the comparison with Rome for all sorts of reasons, and particularly because Tad's insight about Rome's running up against energy limits is new. I do sort of wish Tad would talk in more urgent terms about peak oil, but be that as it may, he very effectively brought together many of the recurring themes on this show. And, to reiterate, to raise these questions is not necessarily to supply the answers, which is part of the work everyone has got to do for themselves. One thing we didn't get into, which I'll try to cover in another conversation, is how to stay at least minimally prepared for a crash, keeping some cash around in case ATMs stop working, several days' supply of food and water, things like that. Tad says he's not a quote-unquote survivalist, and he's not, but in other interviews he has run through some common-sense-type preparations for just in case. I should note that I don't do these things myself either, but I frequently tell myself I should, and maybe this year I'll get around to systematically putting a stopgap-type plan in place. Probably I should have asked Tad's views on gun ownership while I was at it. Okay then, on to next week. My guest will be John Stauber, founder and executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, which is www.prwatch.org. John wrote something on Counterpunch that caught my eye about moveon.org, and this discussion actually follows quite well from the later points in my talk a moment ago with Tad. I didn't plan it that way, but got lucky. And John is a quintessentially sensible Midwesterner. Talking with him makes me nostalgic for Chicago. He's pretty much on the same wavelength as me, so I found a lot to like in our discussion of issues from a grassroots perspective. I hope you make a note to listen. The week following John, if things go as planned, will be a conversation with John McQuaid, a Pulitzer Prize winner and co-author of a recent book on Katrina, Path of Destruction. John has been covering Louisiana issues in a 22-year career with the Times-Picayune of New Orleans, and I think he's got an interesting and an important perspective. I did, as planned, have a conversation with Andrew Coburn, author of a recently published book on Rumsfeld. And it went great, an hour and a half talk in his house in Georgetown. Except that I was using this new professional digital recorder and, I hate to admit this, I set everything up just so, but then forgot to push the record button. The thing works differently than the recorder I've been using most of the past year and habit took over. Andrew was very obliging, very gracious, and we'll try again in a couple of weeks. For those keeping track of such things, I now have got an interview scheduled with Shashi Tharoor of the UN, which I very much hope will work out. At least I've got Shashi's cell phone number, which the day before the interview we're to work out a landline number for me to call. Definitely progress, and I'm optimistic about this one. And thanks to one regular listener, thanks, Robert. I've got an agreement in principle from former Representative Cynthia McKinney to talk with me, but I probably won't get to that for at least a few more weeks. And other irons are in the fire. Thanks very much to those of you who wrote in last week. I really enjoy hearing from you, and I encourage you to write regarding whatever it is you're thinking. Well, okay, that's it for this week. Thank you very much for listening. I'm really happy to provide these shows, and I feel privileged to be able to do it. Remember, stay tuned to Electric Politics.